It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later, we'll learn about two buildings in Wisconsin that are now up for UNESCO World Heritage Site consideration.
Right now, we're continuing our coverage of Governor Walker's proposed state budget, and it's your turn to weigh in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234.
Did you vote for Governor Walker in the last election? If so, is this what you voted for him to do? Do you support the policies that he is enacting, doing what you put him there for? Call 800-642-1234. Or are there things you don't like about Governor Walker's budget, whether you voted for him or not? Call in now, 800-642-1234. You can also react to what we just heard from our last guest, Democratic Representative Chris Taylor, Republican Assembly Speaker Robin Voss. Call in, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. Looking forward to hear what you think.
We'll go to our first caller now. We've got Sherry on the line in Milwaukee. Sherry, hi. Sherry, are you there? And we're going to try to get her back. Sherry, are you with us? She is not. We'll go on to another caller now, and let's talk to Rose in Menominee Falls. Hi, Rose.
Hi there. I am absolutely not in favor of much of this budget, and I've always heard that budgets are equally a policy document as well as a value statement as well as a financial document. And several items, and I'll only reference a couple of them, I think definitely attest to that. And one, of course, is with the UW cuts. I think the amount of the cuts, the small window of time that they've given them to make those cuts. And then when Walker referenced Act 10 as being the UW version of that, and in his speech last night talked about how Act 10 was so successful because our test scores are up and the ACT were second in the nation, et cetera. Well, I have news for him. We've been second in the nation for a long time on the ACT.
Thank you, Rose. Appreciate that. Just want to make sure we have time for other callers. Thank you for sharing your thoughts.
We'll go next to Lori, also in Menominee Falls. Lori, hi.
Hello. Hi, Rose. Rose and I know each other. I don't know whether to be more sad or more angry. There's so much that's appalling here. I'm really interested in the remark that Senator Voss made about unfortunately, ideology is driving the opposition to vouchers. Well, what ideology is driving the Republicans? They have no data that the voucher schools actually do a better job, so that's one point. But what really saddens me, as a 50-year experienced educator and the mother of a new professor in Madison who is a research scientist trying to find the solutions to influenza and AIDS. If $300 million is cut from the university, what message does it send to young investigators, idealists such as my son? What inspiration is there if you change the mission of the university from public service and the public good to business? How inspiring is that for young people?
Lori, thanks a lot for your call. I want to get more listeners in, and you can join in with your reactions to the governor's budget proposal. 800-642-1234 is the number, or share your thoughts at the Central Time Facebook page.
We go next to Mark. Mark joins us from La Crosse. Mark, hi.
Yeah, my comment would be, is I guess I'd use the words that the president said when he was first elected. Elections have consequences, and he pushed his agenda forward that was a liberal agenda. And look at the state of Minnesota where you have Mark Dayton. He doesn't seem to listen to the conservative side. He pushes his agenda. So I think it's pretty much politics as usual, but I think when liberals want to scream about Scott Walker, I think it's a little hypocritical, because when the Democrats get into the leadership position, they don't listen to the other side either. So I think the cuts he's made are based on the election. They elected Republicans for the House and the Republican governor, and I think he's proceeding with the agenda that he was elected to do.
Thank you, Mark, for that. Politics as usual, says Mark.
Yep, we'll go now to Rachel with us in Milwaukee. Rachel, hi.
Hi there.
What do you think?
I just wanted to make a comment. As someone who's worked in urban education in both Indiana and Wisconsin, I just think it's kind of, I don't know, I don't think it's fair for people to actually believe that, you know, Act 10 and the other laws that have been in place have actually helped urban education, because the test scores and the ways that they are getting high schoolers to graduate are totally, they're not being effective. I'll just say that. And I know that from experience in both Indiana, where it's pushed, the private schools are pushed, and charter schools are pushed, and also working for a short time here in Wisconsin.
Rachel, thanks a lot for sharing your thoughts. If you got a busy signal, line just opened up at 800-642-1234 as we talk about the governor's budget proposal.
And we move next to John in Windsor. Hi, John.
Yeah, holy crap. Elimination of the IRIS program, elimination of the family support program for families of children with disabilities, $19 million in cuts to personal care for individuals with disabilities. You know, the whole elimination, the cutting, elimination of words in the Wisconsin idea, in the University of Wisconsin charter. My God, obviously this guy didn't go to elementary school in the state of Wisconsin. He would know about that.
John, thank you so much for your call. Appreciate that.
Sherry is with us now in Milwaukee. Sherry, hi.
Yeah, hi. You know, and I feel like the caller who called and said elections have consequences is right. Elections have consequences. However, this is about, in my opinion, these cuts are really designed to make the governor more appealing to a national audience in his run for president. And we're just a test kitchen. And if we suffer so he can achieve a greater glory, it seems no one cares. If the state of Wisconsin, the cuts to education, having teachers who don't know how to teach, who aren't, you know, skilled in the art of teaching a child. Just because you know a subject doesn't mean you know how to teach a child in classrooms with children is just horrifying. And changing the Wisconsin idea. What in the world is all this about, as well as trying to test people for drugs for public assistance, which we know doesn't work and is too expensive? It's all to appeal to a national audience, and who cares about what happens to real people here in Wisconsin?
Sherry, thanks for your call, taking your thoughts, your reactions, opening the lines to you on Governor Walker's budget proposals from last night. 800-642-1234 or tweet us at Central Time WPR.
Another call here. Stephanie is next in Madison. Hi, Stephanie.
Hi, I'm calling about the idea of extending drug testing for families or individuals who are collecting food stamps, and the idea of putting them through more work training, which could be a good idea, but I think it should be voluntary. I think a lot of these people work multiple jobs. I volunteer at a free clinic for dental work. And they're stretched. And the idea of putting these added pressures on them, I think, is very biased.
Thank you, Stephanie.
And next we've got Judith on the line in Hickston. Judith, hi.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yep. Go for it.
Oh, okay. I just wanted to chime in. I am laid off from the UW system. I am unemployed. So I am one of Scott Walker's unemployed individuals. I was an academic advisor, and I got cut, and I fear so much for this, what I'm hearing, because these cuts will impact student services and the need that students have one-on-one for care, and things like academic advisors and that personal care is what's going to go away, and that just breaks my heart.
Judith, thanks a lot, and thanks for all of your calls. We've been taking your calls on Governor Walker's budget. You can keep the conversation going on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll have more budget coverage today after 5, then tomorrow at 3:30. We'll take a closer look at the economics of the budget. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up in just a few minutes, we'll talk about the two Frank Lloyd Wright buildings in Wisconsin that are now going to be considered for UNESCO World Heritage Site designation.
But first, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Even ugly things can be beautiful sometimes. A Day in Snowshoes helped commentator Christine Sarugi see splendor in her wintry landscape.
I'm one of those few people who love Wisconsin winters. When the snow piles on the roadside and the wind creates moonscape snow dunes, I'm making plans and finding ways to appreciate the season. One Saturday, I cruised down to the Ken Ewers Nature Area for a snowshoe hike with friends. After greetings, we donned our gear and headed on the trail toward the Pulliam Power Plant. The Bay of Green Bay stretched out to our left, but was hidden from view. Living in the Bay Area, I see firsthand the explosion of the invasive species, the loosestrife that congests the water's edge, and recently, the more horrible Phragmites australis, the giant reed grass with its sword-like leaves and thick rootstock. I have bemoaned the Phragmites' willful existence as it took over our sandpit pond. Perhaps it started with some seeds escaping a bird's beak, or from their droppings that took root, slicing up between the rails of the two wooden bridges and thickly rising along the entire pond's edge. Invasive does not even seem the right word for so horrible a plant that has stolen so much land and shoreline. Knowing this, I wasn't surprised to see its searing blonde winter leaves on both sides of the trail and extending far out into the bay. As we trekked along, we saw deer tracks leading down the bay's bank, forging a narrow course through the Phragmites. We followed the path over the bank and onto the snow-laden ice of Green Bay. It's one thing to see these giant green invasives from the road, and quite another to walk between them. The snow cupped the plant base, and the leaves rose up, some bent, some piercing the sapphire sky, others rustling as our jackets brushed against them. Their tasseled seed heads bowed non-defensively, yet the stalks stood straight, tall, as 8-foot shielding sentinels. Blocking the wind, they let in only the warm February sunlight. For once, I didn't curse the Phragmites, but saw the beauty of sand blonde against white and blue, of towering protective height as we stumbled our way over banks, sometimes sinking, snowshoes and all, up to our knees. Making it to the end of the grass zone, we reached the frozen bay that stretched flat white to Longtail Island and beyond. Looking around and back, we could see the slender stalks curve along the bay. Though I begrudged the Phragmites' destructive existence, I could set aside my disdain for those minutes. Just as winter can produce blizzards and treacherous roads, it also can display a serene lunar landscape. Likewise, perhaps just for a moment, the Phragmites too can show beauty. Sometimes we need to suspend a belief to appreciate the splendor of something, wanted or not, to find another kind of treasure.
Darugi is a retired teacher, poet, and writer in De Pere. Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. For more information, visit wisconsinlife.org. Here in Wisconsin, there's a lot of pride when it comes to locally grown architect Frank Lloyd Wright. In addition to designing some of the most memorable buildings in the nation, the American Institute of Architects once called him, quote, the greatest American architect of all time. Now some of his most famous designs could soon get some of the highest honors in the world.
10 buildings designed by Wright were recently nominated to become UNESCO World Heritage Sites. If selected, they would be the first examples of modern works of American architecture to make that list. The 10 buildings are located across 7 states. Wisconsin has 2 of them, the Herbert and Catherine Jacobs House in Madison, as well as Taliesin in Spring Green.
Joining us now to talk about that nomination and the sites themselves is Linda Wagoner. She's the vice president of the Frank Lloyd Wright Building Conservancy. She's also the director of Falling Water, another Wright property up for World Heritage consideration. Linda, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Happy to.
Well, so taking a look at the list of current World Heritage Sites, there's some amazing stuff on that list. The Great Barrier Reef, Machu Picchu, the Great Wall of China, and then here in the U.S., we've got Grand Canyon, the Statue of Liberty. Linda, what would it mean to you to have 10 Frank Lloyd Wright houses added to this list?
Well, I think it's certainly a club we all want to be part of. You know, it's the best of the best worldwide, both in natural and cultural sites.
So what are the steps to becoming a World Heritage Site? I assume it's not real easy.
It's not easy. And in fact, this nomination began in 1991 when both Taliesin and Taliesin West were nominated. And the World Heritage Committee said that those two buildings alone were not sufficiently representative of Wright's work and its global impact, and asked us to prepare a larger nomination. It just took a long time to pull all of that together.
Why did it take so long? What were you looking at?
Well, there are at least 400 extant buildings by Frank Lloyd Wright, and we had to assemble a group of internationally recognized scholars on Wright to choose which buildings were the most representative of his contribution to world architecture. That took a while. Then we had to get on the U.S. tentative list. That's the list from which the United States and any country, every country has a tentative list, from which these countries choose the sites to nominate. So that, again, took a while, and then we had to write the nomination, which is very complex and took quite a while.
Let's talk about some of these sites, and we'll start here in Wisconsin. How about with Taliesin and Spring Green? This is pretty famous here in the state, got some history to back it up. What sticks out to you about Taliesin?
Well, it's probably Wright's largest domestic work, and it's a work that in which the architect was his own client. So in this building, he was able to experiment with ideas over time that he wanted to explore. And it has many connotations from even from the Renaissance villa in Italy. It's drawn from a variety of sources, but Wright shapes it into his own work. And I think it's one of the most important examples of Wright's idea of organic architecture.
And another Wisconsin house by Frank Lloyd Wright is up for consideration, the Herbert and Catherine Jacobs House. What can you tell us about this one and what it looks like?
Oh, yeah. It's a small house. It was probably the most well-known and highly celebrated example of Wright's effort to develop a moderate-cost home for or house for a middle-class family. And in geoculturally, I would say that the house is a brilliant response to the evolving conditions of the day that would be following the Great Depression and the expanding American suburb and the increase in population. So it's with a minimum budget, Wright created a really elegant solution for this family using natural materials. It's an artistic house. The same materials are used on the inside and the outside, and did some very clever things with the siding of the house. It's an L-shaped house, and the apex of the L is tucked into the corner of the site with its back turned to the street, so that when you pull up to the house, you don't really see much except the door and maybe some very narrow clear-story windows. But it opens up into its site and makes the lot seem much larger than one would expect.
Now, in my limited understanding of architecture, is that a calling card of Frank Lloyd Wright, making the building fit the site really well?
Yes, that's probably the most prominent example of what he called organic architecture, was drawing from the site itself to inspire the building and creating a unified whole.
Now, you work at Falling Water, and that's one that is high up on the list of a lot of Frank Lloyd Wright aficionados. What's special about Falling Water?
Oh, well, there's hardly anything that I don't think is special about Falling Water. I think it's a dramatically cantilevered house over a waterfall that took its inspiration from that cantilevered ledge that created the waterfall itself. And it's one of those buildings that hits you in the solar plexus. It's a consummate example of organic architecture. The house kind of grows from the site and climbs down the hillside or cascades down the hillside, much as the waterfall cascades down the stream. It's an extraordinary, extraordinary house.
What kind of reaction do you get from people showing up there and seeing Falling Water up close for the first time?
Yeah, well, funny that you would ask, because over time we've tried to interview people to gain some understanding of their reaction. Invariably, what they say is, wow. they tend not to be very articulate when it comes to describing how they feel about the house. It is a house which does wow you.
What do you think it is about these designs? You know, describe a house as hitting you in the solar plexus. That's not something everyone experiences. So what is it about Frank Lloyd Wright's designs that really stand the test of time?
Well, many architects design very intellectual houses, particularly today. Wright had a certain humanity to his houses that I think people inherently react to. And yet they're at the same time as modern as any modern house for its time, to be sure. So all of those things, I think it's the integration with the setting. It's the genius of, one wonders, how did he figure that out? How did he come to understand that by cantilevering that house or cantilevering that roof, he would achieve a moment of sublime beauty for people?
Linda, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thanks.
We've been speaking with Linda Wagoner, Vice President of the Frank Lloyd Wright Building Conservancy. She's also the director of Falling Water, another Wright property located in Pennsylvania.
Stargazing and checking out the planets has been a favorite hobby for people throughout the ages. But if you want to go beyond just admiring the night sky to being able to understand what you're seeing, our next guest is here to help.
Chris North is an astronomer at the University of Cardiff, and he hosts the BBC television series The Sky at Night. His new book is called How to Read the Solar System, A Guide to the Stars and Planets. Chris, welcome to Central Time.
Hi there.
So anyone can look up and admire that night sky. Why is it better to look up and to understand something more about what we're seeing?
Well, I think you're right that anyone can look up and see what's up in the sky. But it's nice to have an understanding of what you're looking at. So when you look up and see the stars, and you might recognize a few constellations, you can even make up your own constellations of the stars, and you might be able to spot there's some stars that are moving from night to night, or that the moon's in a different place from one night to the next. But then being able to understand why that is and what that tells us about our solar system and the wider universe, I think, is one of the fascinating things about astronomy. And the nice thing is that anyone can do it. You don't need complex, expensive equipment to do really simple observations that, in principle, can tell us a lot.
Well, part of the fun of astronomy, as you said, is the stories that go hand in hand and the history. And just to take the example of the constellations, where did the constellations come from and some of those stories behind them?
Well, most of the constellations are ancient Greek in origin, or certainly based on ancient mythology. So there's some the ancient Greek religions with their gods and all the stories that went with that. Some of them were a bit brutal, so there's some not very nice stories up there. Andromeda, the princess, is chained to a rock, being attacked by Cetus, the sea monster, although we now think of it as a whale. And the hero Perseus is saving her from the vile monster. He's flying on a winged horse, Pegasus, across the sky. So all of those might be names that people might have heard in their school history stuff about the ancient Greek mythology. But there's a few fun constellations as well. There's one I like. It's not a very bright constellation. It's really hard to pick out. It's near the north pole of the sky. It's called Camelopardalis, which means camel leopard, which is actually what they used to call a giraffe, because it's got a long neck like a camel and it's got spots like a leopard. And so before they had a better name for it, that was essentially the Greek name for it, which is quite good fun. And then you end up with some southern hemisphere constellations. So you get things like Dorado, which is, I think it means dolphin fish, or I've heard other people say it means goldfish. And there's a few less mythological names. Telescopium, which is named after the telescope, and Microscopium, and Norma, which is the set square, or the right angle square used in carpentry. So there's a few not so mythological ones as well.
Do the constellations and their names, not to mention the stories, do they change by the culture and the region of the world?
Oh, they do very much so. So there's some ancient certainly Chinese and Arabic constellations that are very different to what we've done, the Western constellations. And some of the names of the features we see have lasted from those ancient times. So there's a cluster of stars in Cancer, the Crab, a cluster called the Beehive Cluster, also called Praesepe, but I think in the, I can't remember exactly which one, it was either Chinese or Arabic, meant exhalation of a pile of corpses, essentially, which isn't particularly pleasant. But there are some weird and wonderful objects out there, or names of objects out there, that change. The stars themselves don't move on human timescales, so this is really is a feature of people's imagination over the millennia, rather than anything else.
Well, let's talk about the most important star in our galaxy, at least, you know, from the perspective of good old planet Earth, the Sun. What do we need to know to better appreciate the Sun?
Well, there's the Sun. There's a bunch of sort of subtleties about the Sun that you can look at. Obviously, when you look up on a nice clear day, you can see it blazing away in the sky. But the Sun was looked at in the 19th century by physicists more than astronomers, looking at what we call its spectrum, so its rainbow of colours. So most people, I'm sure, have seen a rainbow at some point or other, just the light from the Sun being spread out into its constituent colours. If you study that in detail, you see there are some colours that are darker than others. There's a bit of light blocked out at particular colours. You can't see that if you look at a rainbow, you don't see it. But if you look at it with a particular equipment, you can do that. In fact, you can do that with a darkened box and a CD or a DVD. A CD actually works better. Put a slit and have the light reflecting off the CD, and you can see this rainbow spread out. And those dark lines in the Sun actually are a fingerprint of what the Sun is made of. So we see some dark lines that are then known from laboratory experiments to correspond to hydrogen. The Sun is mostly made of hydrogen gas. In fact, the universe as a whole is mostly made of hydrogen gas. But not long after these absorption lines, they're formed by particular elements that are absorbing very precise colours of the Sun's light, that led to identification of a new element called helium. Helium, after the Greek word for helios, the Sun. So the element helium, which is the second most abundant element in the universe, was discovered by looking at our Sun, which is quite fun. And there's also sunspots, of course. So while, again, you can't see them with the naked eye, people may remember from a few years ago when we had the transit of Venus, and now and again there's a solar eclipse. So there's another partial solar, well, there's a solar eclipse coming up at the end of March, which is a total eclipse from the North Atlantic, very far North Atlantic. And if you look at it through eclipse glasses and make sure you're safe, never look at the Sun with any optical device at all, because you can run the risk of going blind, you see these sunspots, some of which are as large as the Earth, or often bigger than the Earth, and tell us about the Sun's magnetic field and its magnetic properties, and that has impacts on eruptions of material we call coronal mass ejections, which come flying towards the Earth at a million miles an hour. And can cause us problems with satellites and navigation and communication and so on. So there's a lot of subtleties that aren't quite so apparent when you just see this yellow ball in the sky.
Now, you said never look at the Sun with, I think you said, with a, you know, in some sort of device, you'll go blind. Is that's actually true, like with the naked eye as well? If I were to look at the Sun midday, would I go blind?
Well, clearly, if you glance at the Sun in the middle of the day, you don't go blind. I'm sure everyone's done that at some point. The important thing is that the Sun is actually very bright. If you stare at the Sun, and if you look at the Sun for more than a few seconds and then you blink, you'll see there's an after image on your eye. So you'll see a little black mark in your vision, and that goes away eventually. The danger of looking at it through any magnifying apparatus, so that can be binoculars or a telescope, or it can even be the viewfinder on a camera, is that that's magnifying that light. And the Sun hasn't only got the visible light we see, there's also infrared light and ultraviolet light that come off it, and it's particularly those that can do a lot of damage to your retina, to your eye, can cause permanent damage. And many an early solar astronomer ends up with vision problems through doing that. So it is very important to make sure you either consult someone who knows what they're doing or have experience and know what you're doing yourself before you go and try and do anything with the Sun. And also, what some people have asked, I know, is can you take a picture of it with a camera, with a digital camera? And again, the answer is it is risky to do that, because again, that light is being focused on the detector chip of your camera, which is either maybe in a camera or in a phone or in a tablet device or something, that, again, it can damage the electronics at the back of that if you're not careful. So you do have to be wary, and if in doubt, don't, when thinking about looking at the sun.
You mentioned sunspots before and the electromagnetic field there, and I know this is tied to the aurora, which is one of the coolest things that we can see on Earth with the naked eye anyway. Tell us about how that connection works.
You're right, the aurora, we call them the northern lights in the northern hemisphere, a bit selfishly perhaps. There's the southern lights over Antarctica as well, of course, are caused by particles moving very quickly through the Earth's atmosphere. They're being accelerated around the Earth's magnetic field, and they're causing them to bash into atoms in the high up in the Earth's atmosphere, and that bashing causes them to release light. And the particular atoms that are being energized in this way depends on the color. So we often get reds from oxygen, and greens, which are the dominant color in aurora, come predominantly from nitrogen. Now those atoms and that magnetic field is always there, but what happens is every now and again the sun has this enormous eruption of material from its surface, often from near the Earth. There's a sunspot, there's a flare, which is a bright burst of energy which throws material out. It can throw about 1 billion tons of material, which sounds like a lot. It's not much for the sun. The sun is incredibly massive, of course. But it's 1 billion tons of material moving at about 1 million miles an hour, coming straight, sometimes, not always, and mostly not, but now and again, straight towards us. That material carries with it magnetic fields from the sun, and the sun has a very powerful magnetic field. And when that reaches the Earth, it sort of energizes the Earth's own magnetic field. It adds energy to the Earth's magnetic field and causes all these particles to move more quickly. And because they're moving more quickly, they're bashing into atoms more, and that causes the lights to be released. And it also, we think of the aurora is linked to where the magnetic field lines of the Earth, if you've ever seen the magnetic field of a bar magnet in high school, maybe, imagine that in three dimensions. That's a bit like what the Earth's magnetic field looks like. Where that comes in through the surface of the Earth is this circle called the auroral oval, which is centered roughly over the Earth's magnetic North Pole, which is up in Canada somewhere. And when we get these events coming from the sun, that auroral oval spreads southwards. So that's when you start to see the aurora at more southerly locations. And because the North Pole is over your side of the planet, you see that more often than we do down here in the UK. You have to be in pretty far north in the UK. But I guess in the northern US, it's not as uncommon as it is here to see the aurora on a clear, dark night.
We're getting an astronomy lesson right now with Chris North. He's a professor of astronomy and physics at Cardiff University, the host of the BBC television series The Sky at Night, and the co-author of the new book called How to Read the Solar System.
And you can join the conversation. Are there mysteries about our solar system you'd like our guests to shed some light on? What kind of luck do you have watching the stars from your backyard, maybe with your home telescope? What's the most fantastic thing you've seen in the night sky? Call 800-642-1234, that's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're getting to know the night sky a little bit better with Chris North. He's a professor of astronomy and physics at Cardiff University and co-author of How to Read the Night Sky.
You can join the conversation with your questions and your best stargazing experiences at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about something you've seen in the sky at night or where to look for something in the sky? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email talk at WPR.org.
Now, Chris, as a sky watcher, are there any major astronomical events that we should be on the lookout for, at least in North America, in the coming winter?
Well, one of the nice things about the night sky is that it sort of doesn't matter whether, or most of the time, it doesn't matter whether you're in North America or Northern Europe. The sky is essentially the same. You just see them a few hours later than we do. So the best thing to look out for tonight when the sun sets is if you've got a clear western horizon, go out and you should see Venus blazing away in the twilight sky. You can't miss it. It's the brightest thing around. So that's the next planet in towards the sun from where we are. And was one of the things, the observations of Venus early on actually told us that helped us prove that the Earth went around the sun rather than the sun going around the Earth a few hundred years ago, of course. The other thing to look out for then, as it gets dark, you'll see rising in the east, and then setting at the end of the night, at sunset, you'll see the planet Jupiter. Again, a bright object rising in the east, travelling across the south, and then setting in the west. And that's, again, the brightest thing in that part of the sky. Jupiter's actually at its brightest at the moment. It's the opposite part of the sky to the sun, which is why it rises at sunset and sets at sunrise. So it's something we call opposition in astronomy. That means it's its brightest and its biggest. So if you do have access to a telescope, now is very much the time to go and look at Jupiter. If you have a big enough telescope, which might be one that's, say, 6 to 8 inches across in terms of the main mirror, the main lens, then you might even be able to see the moon traveling across the face of it. The moons are easy enough to see through a small telescope, but you can see their shadows and see the moons themselves passing across the face of Jupiter if you have a big enough telescope. So those are the two things that are really bright in the sky at the moment. There's the standard constellations. Orion is on its way out. In the next month or so, Orion will start to disappear into the evening twilight, and we head in towards the summer constellations. So we've got things like Auriga and Gemini, which are nice patterns to look at in the spring skies. And then in a few months, we'll end up with things like Leo the Lion coming to the fore. And other planets will take the place of Jupiter, as Jupiter eventually in a few months is in the evening twilight. We'll start to see the planet Saturn will be becoming easier to see. So there's certainly lots to see. As I mentioned earlier, one of the things to look out for is this solar eclipse on the 20th, well, our time is our morning of, in the UK, the 20th of March. So, yeah, that will be, in fact, no, it will be dark where you are, so I'm afraid that won't work. but yeah, so stick to the night, guys. So Jupiter and Venus are the things to look out for at the moment.
Well, let's go with Venus for a minute. Now, is that the planet that has a slightly reddish hue, or am I mixing it up with Mars?
Mars is the one that has a reddish hue. That's very low in the west at the moment, so that's very hard to see now. It really is disappearing into the evening twilight. Venus looks like a bright white object, and it's pretty much one of the most reflective objects in the solar system because of its very, very thick atmosphere. It's got a runaway greenhouse effect that's been in place for hundreds of millions of, if not longer, billions of years, perhaps, that cooks its atmosphere to incredibly high temperatures and pressures, so not a nice place to go and visit if you ever get the opportunity.
Now, Saturn is amazing through a telescope, but can you tell us a little bit about that planet? Because if you're lucky enough to see this one a little bit magnified, it's worth it.
Very much so. Saturn is, I would say, the hook for many an amateur astronomer. In fact, there are most amateur astronomers I speak to who just love looking at the night sky will say that Saturn is the thing that really got them hooked. Because when you look in through a telescope, you see this planet doesn't look like a little round disc like most planets do. This planet has rings. So Saturn's famous for its ring system, and it really does have an impressive ring system. If you get a moderately sized telescope, then you can start to really see the detail, the subtle detail on the planet's surface, but you can start to see detail in Saturn's rings themselves. So the rings are made of tiny particles, tiny, tiny grains of ice and dust, mostly ice, very icy material. And one of the things we've learned from is a mission called the Cassini probe that's orbiting Saturn at the moment. And it's been there for about, well, getting on for 10 years now. That's shown us that the rings of Saturn are incredibly thin. They're hundreds of thousands of miles across, but they're tens of meters thick at their thinnest. So they're incredibly thin compared to their diameter. So it really is astonishing that we can see them in such detail from here. And one of the really fascinating things about Saturn's rings is we don't know how old they are. We don't know how long they've been there. And it's really hard to try and find out. We would expect them to be darker and dirtier if they've been there for a long time, because gradually dust would have built up on the surface of all these little tiny little chunks of ice. But the fact that they're very bright might mean that either they're much more recent or that something keeps it clean. Not that there's someone with a broom going around and sweeping them, but with the little ice particles bash into each other and keep each other nice and shiny and clean. That's the favoured theory at the moment. But they really are fascinating to look at through a small telescope.
Let's take a caller now. Alan joins us from Cameron. Hi, Alan.
Hi. Yeah, I just wanted to say the coolest thing I've seen recently in the night sky was there was a fireball that had exploded over Michigan, and I happened to be outside when it happened, and that was pretty cool.
A fireball meaning, what do you think, an asteroid? Or a...
Yeah.
Okay, what about that, Chris North? An asteroid, you know, Alan's calling it a fireball over the sky. What is it like to see one of those?
I've never actually seen a proper fireball, sometimes called a bolide. These are often not actually that large space rocks, if you like, asteroids. So lumps of rock that are coming through, traveling through the solar system all the time, and now and again they end up passing through our atmosphere. A fireball typically, unless apart from the really, really big ones that we see, normally they're blocks of rock that are, well, anywhere from the size of a brick to the size of a, you know, a reasonably large boulder. So they're not actually that big compared to how bright they look, but they can be fantastic. A famous one a few years ago was the Chelyabinsk region of Russia had a fireball went over it, and there were videos online of that. And now CCTV cameras are becoming much more common in things like petrol stations around all over the place, that you get a lot of footage now of people posting their videos online of seeing these things go over. And they really are, must be impressive to see. I've never properly seen one myself. I've always managed to be looking in the wrong direction, I think. But they're rare, so if you do see one, you're very lucky. They don't happen that often.
Well, thanks a lot for that call, Alan. And Carol called and said she wants to know when and how you can see the space station.
So the space station does go over fairly regularly. It orbits the Earth every 90 minutes. So it goes over some part of the Earth every 90 minutes. When we see it, it tends to be on the hours just after, or just after sunset, or just before sunrise. The reason for that is that's when it's it's high enough that it's still in sunlight, whereas we're in the Earth's shadow down on Earth, hence it being nighttime. It's actually quite hard to predict. I don't have the dates for where you can see it from where you are at the moment, but there are various ways of finding out. There's the NASA website. If you do an internet search for NASA space station visibility, you generally put in your location and it will tell you for the next, say, 10 days of whether it's going over. There's a very good website called heavensabove.com, so heavens-above.com, which will tell you, again, you put in your location, it tells you when the space station's going over. And when you see it, it will be going from west to east, and it will be incredibly bright.
And we leave it there. Chris, thank you so much for joining us today.
No problem. Thank you.
We've been speaking with Chris North, a professor of astronomy and physics at Cardiff University, and he's the co-author of the new book, How to Read the Solar System.